The Tom Woods Show, episode 1916.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, don't even think about missing the libertarian event of the year. The 2000th episode of The Tom Woods Show, live in Orlando, featuring many of your favorites from The Tom Woods Show. And Michael Malice says his special surprise guest, whose identity I myself don't even know, will bring the house down. Cost nothing to attend. Register at tomwoods2000.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Today, with Marco Bassani of the University of Milan, we're going to be talking about a critical decade in American history, and that's the 1790s. So now the Constitution is ratified, and we have the United States, we have George Washington as president, but already we see two warring camps. And we're going to talk about the significance of this today as we cover some of the material in just, we're only on chapter 3 of Marco's book, Chaining Down Leviathan, The American Dream of Self-Government, 1776 to 1865. Marco, welcome back.
All right. Thanks for having me, Tom.
All right. Let's get back to where we were. Let's go into after the Philadelphia Convention. Let's talk about the 1790s. Now, as we go into the 1790s, I know there are people who say it's a bad thing to have political parties, but given that there were a couple of competing ways to look at and understand the United States, it seems inevitable that people would group themselves into one or another of these ideas. Now, our friend Don Livingston says that although in the 1790s and beyond, you can find numerous expositions of what we call the compact theory of the Union, whereby the states created the federal government, the peoples of the states are the sovereigns, the federal government has only the powers delegated to it, it's merely the states are the creators, the federal government is just its agent, and then they can withdraw these powers just as easily as they delegated them. This is something like the compact theory of the Union. He says there is no self-consciously written out defense of the nationalist theory of the Union, which holds the United States to be a single consolidated whole with the states as mere departments of the center. You don't see that until the 1830s. Now, do you think that's right?
I think that's perfectly correct. I don't think you even see that in the 30s. I think you don't see that. You don't clearly see something coming out as a construction of the Union as a unitary state, like France, you know, making the United States like a new France. No, there's nothing of that sort until nowadays, until our time, right? Because it's only in our times that radicals would go as far as asking for the destruction of the Electoral College, asking for to just avoid the states altogether or destroy the states altogether. We know it was a position that Alexander Hamilton took in the convention in 1787, but he knew he just voiced it because he knew it was secret, right? Secret works of the convention. But, you know, there's even Henry Adams said the doctrine of states' rights was in itself a sound and true doctrine as a starting point of American history and constitutional law. There's no other which will bear a moment's examination, right? Henry Adams, you know, so we're talking late in the 1800s. So the compact theory of the Union is the states got together, gave some powers of government, but not sovereignty, to delegated some powers to the common agent of the state, which was the federal government, of course, and nothing else. That they did not divest themselves of their supposed sovereignty. Now, one thing that I want to make clear is that you could use either the states' right doctrine of Thomas Jefferson, who never uses the word sovereignty for the states, right? He never uses the doctrine of sovereignty, the word sovereignty. He just says that there's no common arbiter between the state. Or you could use the one based on the sovereignty of the single state, of the Union, right? Not of the Union, but of the state that participated to the Union that was adopted later on in the 1830s by Calhoun. It doesn't make much of a difference in terms of the commands of the whole thing. But I wanted to make sure that you could defend that theory also in a sort of Lockean terms. The states are one another in a state of nature. There's no common arbiter. There's no common judge between them. So the only thing you have to be sure is that you do not believe that the Supreme Court is somewhat the arbiter between the states and the Federation. And of course, to these people, it would make no sense because the Supreme Court was a creature or the creation or part of the federal government. And it couldn't be the arbiter between two powers, the federal government and the state.
Now we get into the 1790s. That's what we're talking about in this episode. But now I want to talk about the specific historical events that occurred and not just the ideas that were floating around. And the standard ones that get discussed are the conflict between Hamilton and Jefferson in the Washington administration, and then the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798 and nullification. Now, I've talked an awful lot about, I really have talked myself hoarse about the principles of 1798 and the Alien and Sedition Acts and the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions. Give me an overview, because if I look at a typical American history textbook, it does not really describe this material very well, I think. And the significance of 1798 is missed entirely. So how would you give an overview of this material that would be a corrective to what a textbook might say?
Well, the problem is clear. You know, if you read the Kentucky resolutions, and then you realize that Thomas Jefferson could be considered both the father of the United States, because he wrote the Declaration of Independence, but also the father of the CSA, Confederate States of America, who seceded in 1861, exactly on those principles, or using those principles. I don't want to go into that debate about secession, slavery, or constitutional doctrine, but clearly in 1798, Thomas Jefferson started what was going to be the most important gloss to the Constitution, the most important interpretation of the Constitution. Now, we know the whole thing, and so that's why they don't talk too much about it. Actually, you take the major biographers of Thomas Jefferson, and there's the number one, right, a guy who wrote six books from 1948 to 1981 and on. And so he wrote six books, and only four or five pages were devoted to the Kentucky Resolutions of 1798. And the guy was a Southerner, Dumont Malone, right? So it's like Dumont Malone. And so it's like something you don't talk about, because that interpretation of the Constitution, that was called actually the Jeffersonian Doctrine of 1798, was going to stay and was going to be like the real... For quite a while, it was going to be the real matter of the dispute between the two sections of the country. Actually, the two sections of the country, you know that the first section that tried secession was New England at the Hartford Convention in 1814. So the idea of the Union as to be decided every time and to be put on trial by the state, by the single state, and by the several states, was very, very common in 1798, in 1814, 1830, and so on. So we know everything. You don't want to go into the alien and sedition laws that were, that would be, I tell you what, in 1788 that passed the crop, what was called the crop of 1788, was all these laws, alien and sedition laws and other acts that were passed on the 4th of July, right, Declaration of Independence, 4th of July of 1798. If we had anything of that sort nowadays, even the most liberals would say this is impossible, right? So it was something really unconceivable for that generation. And in relation to the freedom of speech and so on. So Thomas Jefferson drafted the Kentucky Resolution, and the Kentucky Resolution, well, James Madison drafted the Virginia Resolutions, which are somewhat more moderate. But the Kentucky Resolution was really the greatest contribution to a constitution to which he took no part, right? We know because he was a minister in France. So he felt that federalism was so important that it was even more important than the rights of man, the rights of natural rights. So a centralized republic for Jefferson, one and indivisible like France, was always and necessarily tyrannical, even if it formally recognized the natural rights of the people. He said it over and over again, the true barriers of our liberty are our state governments. Individual rights actually remain like the core of the center of his political thought for Thomas Jefferson, but the way to enforce and to protect individual rights is through federalism, through authentic federalism. And it's only this states' rights long tradition that sees that freedom comes from a weak federal government. In the American community, in the Union, there's only one potential oppressor, the Federation, the federal government, not the states, because the states can be changed through a democratic process. They can you can change the government, you can vote, and so on. But if you put power, if you consolidate power into one single center, that is the real threat.
Hey, everybody, let's take a minute to thank our sponsor, Stamps.com. Old Woods here ships out an awful lot of packages. People order books from me. I send out goodies to people at certain levels of the Supporting Listeners program. And the hassle of going to the post office and waiting in line got to the point where I actually hired somebody. I paid somebody to take my packages and bring them to the post office. Ah, but then Stamps.com came along. Mail and ship anytime, anywhere, right from your computer, send letters, ship packages, and pay less, a lot less, with discounted rates from USPS, UPS, and more. It's an absolute must-have for any business, whether you're a small office sending invoices, or a side hustle Etsy shop shipping out orders, or just navigating this hybrid work life, Stamps.com can handle it all with ease. No wonder over a million businesses choose Stamps.com for their mailing and shipping. Not to mention, you get discounts up to 40% off post office rates and up to 66% off UPS shipping rates. So stop wasting time going to the post office and go to Stamps.com instead. There's no risk. And with my promo code WOODS, you get a special offer that includes a four-week trial plus free postage and a digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in WOODS. That's Stamps.com, promo code WOODS. Stamps.com, never go to the post office again. I remember reading quite a while ago your book, I guess it came out in 2010, Liberty, State, and Union, The Political Theory of Thomas Jefferson. I wrote a review of it. And I remember you, I distinctly remember you saying, and I guess it's not distinctive, I can't remember the exact words, but you identified the Kentucky Resolutions of 1798 as being a document of great importance and really the classic exposition of the compact theory of the Union, which is why, to me, it's so significant that if you look at a documentary reader of the United States, you'll get some inaugural addresses that we're all supposed to read and memorize and this or that thing, but you probably won't get the Kentucky Resolutions of 1798, even though it clearly is central to the way people looked at the Union for a very long time. All you had to say was Principles of 98, and people in all sections of the country knew what you meant.
Yeah, they were very important for a long time. And actually, there is a push in contemporary American to forget about the states in general, right? Actually, it was this COVID 2019 that reminded us that this is a union of states, right? And America was coping with COVID as peoples, various peoples of several states. There were different regulations and so on, but it was a long, long push after Reagan to forget about the states. Well, you know that Reaganomics, before we called it Reaganomics, it was called New Federalism, right? So it was really a new idea of giving power back to the state. I remember Barack Obama in 2009, actually, first inaugural address. He kept talking about those men who wrote our Constitution without even thinking that they were delegates of the states, right? Of course they were men. They were important people. And men, we want to study and know everything about it, but they were sent there by the states, right? And it was approved by the states. You know, there is a certain new wave to just get over with this states. But, listen to this. He says, when in the Kentucky Resolutions, whenever the general government assumes undelegated powers, the acts are void and of no force. To this compact, each state acceded as a state and is an integral party, its co-states forming the other party. So you are a state, you enter into the Constitution as you ratify, and you enter into a pact in which the other party are all the rest of the states. So it means the federal government is not part of the pact. It was the object of the pact because it did not exist before the pact. Now, we all have this new political science, or, you know, you read a book about governmental relations, and that means, you know, there is like a dialectic between the states and the federal government. The federal government is the product of the compact between the states. It's not part of the compact.
Right. So it's even wrong sometimes when people innocently try to draw an analogy between people entering into a contract, which I've even done just to help people understand what's going on. And we say the states have a contract with the federal government. You have two sides to a contract. But that's not even it. The states created the federal government by means of a compact among themselves. The federal government didn't exist at the time, so they couldn't very well have made a contract with something that didn't yet exist. But again, all this is lost. These sorts of subtleties are typically lost because no one's even asking the questions these days. So Jefferson, in the Kentucky Resolutions, which it was not known he had authored, but...
Well, he was vice president, so he couldn't...
Right, know. It's a little bit awkward, right? When you're undermining what the president is doing.
Yeah.
There was some suspicion. And then later on, well, the following year, you had the Kentucky Resolutions of 1799, where the word nullification, which had been removed from the 1798 document, did appear. And then years later, around 1832, James Madison claimed that Jefferson had never used the word nullification. And then someone showed him in Jefferson's handwriting the word nullification in there.
Yes.
So just totally crazy stuff. But
He called nullification a natural right of the state, right? So that was like it had the highest status in Jeffersonian thought, considering it the natural right of a state.
Can I ask you something? You do cover it in chapter 3 of your book that comes up from time to time, and I want to try to get to the bottom of why it matters. And that's the question of common law and whether there's a federal common law. Jefferson said no. Why does that matter?
Well, it matters a lot. You know, the idea that there is no federal... Actually, there's an almost, a big part of a book which was written by, it's called The Virginia Report, 1800. So it was a general book on the Jeffersonian doctrine, and it was written by James Madison. It's a perfect book. It explores a lot of things. And one thing that was totally debunked, we would say nowadays, was the idea that there was a federal common law. Because if you had a federal common law that tied this country or this assemblage of nations to England once and for all, then what was the revolution all about, right? So if you could come up with a federal common law, the whole Constitution would have no effect. And the Supreme Court would be the court of last resort for all common law cases coming back from the Middle Ages and a lot of ages that founding fathers considered to be quite dark. But the other thing was clear. Of course, there was an American common law, but there were as many American common laws as there are states. It just stopped short of the federal government. Now, this vision of the non-federal common law was actually used, even was expounded by the Supreme Court in the early 1814, 1820s, and so on. But then it was, of course, pretty much lost in American history because it didn't give enough power to the judiciary, to the Supreme Court, so they wanted to grab as much power as possible. But I think that makes perfect sense in explaining, first of all, the revolutionary fracture from the British Empire, and second of all, the federal nature of the American Union. That is, you have as many common laws as there are states, but not a single federal common law, because at that point, everything would be decided by a court of last appeal, that is, the Supreme Court, and the courts and the state courts would simply do not exist. They wouldn't exist.
Well, that leads, I think, to a key question that most people think they know the answer to, which is, in the American system, what is the arbiter of last resort?
Yeah, that is like the ultimate question of American federalism. You know, so it's Thomas Jefferson and John Calhoun and all these people knew the answer. And then, well, Thomas Jefferson would say the supermajority of the states that can do whatever they want with the Constitution and the Union, or a single state, actually a single state that tried nullification. And actually, in Calhoun's view, it would be the single state that tried nullification of a federal law. Then the rest of the states decided that that law was so important and they would put that law into the Constitution. So that would be part of the American Compact. At that point, the American Compact would be different from the one that it was signed, ratified by the state in 1788-89. So they would have the right to secede and leave the Union. Right, so there's an escalation of remedies, constitutional remedies, that goes from nullification to secession. But secession, legal secession, that is constitutional secession, not the, like the right of revolution that was, of course, you know, recognized by every person of free lands. You know, when they enslave you, you have a right to revolution. But that's not the idea. The idea is you acceded to a pact, a certain pact, then they change the entire Constitution. And so you have to decide whether to just enter a new pact or just whether you want to be by yourself. And that is using your supreme rights of sovereignty of the state. So who is the judge of last resort? It cannot be the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court is part of the federal government. That would make clearly that so the government created by this pact was created as a limited government. If you put a department of the federal government as the judge of the extension of the power, then the Constitution means nothing at all. You know, that there's just the idea of limited government is gone, you know. So the other thing you could say, well, the judge of last resort is the peoples, the various peoples of the several states, or in the super last resort, a single people of a single state.
Well, when I do want to have you on again in the future, and we'll talk about Calhoun and see if he took a somewhat different view of nullification from Jefferson with regard to what a single state could do. You know, by the way, sometimes we hear people say we need to amend the Constitution to fix some of the problems. And I'm of two minds on this. If all you want to do is try to change the wording of the general welfare clause because you think that means the federal government won't do what it wants to anymore, I think you're in for a surprise. That's not going to matter. But if you make a structural change to the Constitution, that could have a good effect. So if you were to say something like, you know, all right, look, we should recognize the right of state nullification of unconstitutional federal laws, but unfortunately, we've all been taught to despise that. So what we'll do is we'll amend the Constitution to say something like, if a majority of states declare that they believe a particular law to be unconstitutional, then it is simply repealed, or even one-third of the states. Or you might even say, if even one state says we think this is unconstitutional. So in other words, in order for the federal government to pass something that would allegedly benefit the whole country, it better benefit the whole country, or it's not going to survive. What do you think about a reform like that?
I think it's impossible. I think I'm really afraid of majorities nowadays, right? So I would be very afraid of any push for constitutional reform.
All right, let's suppose, forget about the dangers of a convention, if there are any. Forget about that.
Right.
Suppose
no
tomorrow we could have that reform in the Constitution. Would things be better?
No. If we could get that, but that is, science fiction, but I like it. I mean, I like this, the idea of putting that good words in the Constitution, but we better stick to the founding fathers and those so-called framers that were at least, you know, much better. It would be, if we had a constitutional convention, there would be certainly more chances of seeing the Communist Manifesto approved by the people than anything else. So please, you know, let's stick to what we have. Because I'm a realist in my politics. But if you said, you know, let's put something that clearly make sense, like the amendment you articulated, it certainly makes sense, and I would approve it immediately. But the, you know, this is Lincoln. I don't want to jump into Lincoln, but there's a very famous 4th of July speech, which is called by our friend Donald Livingstone, the spectacular lie. And he said something that that really stuck into the American public. And he said the states have their status in the Union. They have no other legal status. If they break from us, they can do only so only against law and by revolution. The Union and not themselves separately procure their independence and their liberty. By conquest or purchase, the Union gave each of them whatever of independence and liberty it has. The Union is older than any of the states. And in fact, it created them as states. It makes no sense at all. But this is the way that our people in the departments of history think about the Union. It's it happened in 1981. Ronald Reagan said, well, the states are older than the Union. He thought he was saying, you know, this water is kind of warm and something very, you know, a trite banality, but it was not. Immediately, Samuel Beer and all the others, you know, came up and said, no. What are you talking about? The Union is older. It started even before we thought about a revolution, you know. So there's this construction, there's this worship of the Union that stays there with great, well, progressives and a lot of the American people. And I would be very, very suspicious of any constitutional reform given our political climate.
Well, I think I may have covered this in the past. When you get to almost 2,000 episodes, you probably covered pretty much everything. So I'll go back and look in the list to see if I discussed the issue of an amendments convention. You know, our friend Kevin Gutzman supports it, and I'm not as opposed to it.
I support it. I support the idea, but I'm just afraid.
No, I hear you. I definitely hear you. Yeah. I was just thinking in terms of how to approximate what a federal system is supposed to look like with the states as a check on the federal government. I will say, as I said to Brian McClanahan earlier this week, that the coronavirus situation, you know, for all our griping about the death of federalism, I have to say, on a very, very important matter, federalism is alive and well, or otherwise there wouldn't be a Florida, or they wouldn't be a South Dakota and some of these other states. We did have that. We did have governors that said, we're not doing it. And even when Joe Biden got in, he didn't do anything to change that. There is that.
Actually, this is what I thought. I always thought it from the beginning, from April 2020. I just said, well, it's a federation of states. Not only that, not only in America, all over the world. You know, I saw the COVID both in the United States. I was in the United States one year ago when it started. Then I was in Italy. Then I was back in the States and so on. The thing I can tell you, this entire thing brought about localities, local government, local solutions to certain things. People are realizing that Italy, the United States, France, Germany, they're too big to control the territory. There's and one single command room, which is actually what is, as we said, you know, the centerpiece of the modern state, to create one single command room just cannot be the solution. It is a very simple solution, but it does not work at all. You know, in Italy, they had regions. Regions are not states. It's a regional system. But still, when there was COVID, supposedly, it could not move from one region to the other. So clearly, they were acknowledging the existence of regions and borders among regions and certain things that were not very commonly acknowledged by the central government.
Well, we're going to call it quits there because there are so many other topics we can get into in your book that I would like to do in the future. But for now, let me remind everybody, you should read this book. It's the kind of book that will not be assigned to you in school. That's my favorite kind. It's Chaining Down Leviathan, The American Dream of Self-Government, 1776 to 1865, by our guest, Marco Bassani, and I'm linking to it on our show notes page, tomwoods.com/1916. Thanks again, Marco. We'll do it again sometime soon, I hope.
Thanks a lot. This is the beginning of the book says this is not part of the 1619 project. but it was very appalled. I hope nobody believes I'm racist or anything, but it's not part of that idea that the only thing that happened to this land was slavery. No, there were a lot of other things that we could talk about.
I can't imagine anyone could think ill of Marco Bassani. That I refuse to live in such a world.
Thank you, Tom. You're a friend.
All right, everybody, that's another week of the Tom Woods Show. If you like and appreciate what the old man is doing here, then check out supportinglisteners.com and support the show and become a member of the Tom Woods Show Elite, where you know in your heart of hearts you belong. You get a great many bonuses, and a brand new bonus, not even listed on the site as of this moment, is that at the 2000th episode event in Orlando in October 2021, you get a special reception that the average Joe off the street does not get. With me and a whole bunch of other like-minded people, we'll be having drinks and lots of fun together before the event gets started. And if you're at the super-duper elite levels, if you're at the platinum level or above in supporting the show, then you also get to be part of a super-duper exclusive reception at that event held in the hospitality suite with all the special guests for the evening. So it's going to be absolutely great. I'm always adding extra benefits. I mean, for heaven's sake, I even have people over at my house. So go ahead and join over there at supportinglisteners.com, and I'll see you next week.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.